They knew that they had been badly outnumbered. They were equally aware that they had faced a Union foe that was just as brave and tough and resourceful as they were. This was news to many of them. They had marched 12 to 15 miles in the morning, had been subjected to galling artillery fire, then had stood with astounding bravery at a stone wall for 2 hours under a barrage of Union lead. They had fought to their last bullet and were deeply proud of what they had done. "It was a terrific fight, and all our men behaved like heroes," wrote Alexander Boatler, Jr. of the Rockbridge Artillery, son of the congressman. "No one left his posts unless ordered off the ground. Our canister scattered them like scared sheep and made them all run." The almost universal feeling was that with ammunition, they would have held. The little army had been heavily engaged, and although confronted by large odds, held its own, and only retired after shooting all its ammunition away, wrote John Worsham of the 21st Virginia Regiment. "It seems to me that the 21st Virginia would have held its line indefinitely if it had been supplied with ammunition. It was a regular stand-up fight with us, and as stated, the men fought as I never saw any fighting during the war." Even Loring's old regiment seemed to find a new respect for their commander, and Confederate prisoners, to a man, expressed pride at what they had done. Southern newspapers echoed the same sentiment. If their facts were slightly skewed, they fully understood that a very small force had stood toe-to-toe with a much larger one. "No battle has been fought during the war against such odds," said the Richmond Dispatch. "With a force not exceeding 3,500 men who had been on forced marches for weeks, we attacked 20,000 fresh troops, repulsed them again and again, until overpowered by numbers." The paper gave Jackson full credit. "A braver man God never made." Amid all the recent bad news from the scattered Confederate armies, here, at least, was an example of pluck and courage. Here was hope. Jackson himself did not believe he had lost the fight. According to his map-maker, Jed Hotchkiss, he never considered that he was beaten at Kernstown. To Anna, he wrote 5 days after the battle, "My little army is in excellent spirits. It feels that it inflicted a severe blow upon the enemy." The gruesome scene they left behind was witness to it. A pocked and devastated landscape full of pooled blood and bodies and pieces of limbs, clothing, hats, weapons, and a bewildering variety of personal items. Across the top of the wall, running its entire length, was a jagged line of blood, the residue of hundreds of Union mini-balls hitting Confederate skulls. A bloody severed foot hung from a tree, testimony to the brute violence that had put it there. "The small bushes were cut to pieces, and every tree was filled with balls," wrote John C. Marsh of the 29th Ohio. "The dead lay thickly in these woods and behind the stone wall, some all torn to pieces with shell, some badly mangled with canister, but by far the larger portion were killed with rifle balls." It was curious to note the different expressions on the faces of the dead. Some seemed to have died in the greatest agony. Others wore a smile even in death. Sandy Pendleton thought that, though smaller in scale, the Battle of Kernstown was a harder fight than Manassas. In the end, Union casualties exceeded Confederate casualties, perhaps predictably, considering that much of the battle amounted to an assault on a fortified position. The totals were 118 Federals killed, 450 wounded, and 22 captured or missing. 80 Confederates killed, 375 wounded, and 263 captured. Though he had expressed satisfaction with his performance, Jackson was frustrated that he had come, as he saw it, so agonizingly close to a draw against a superior foe. His unhappiness quickly manifested itself in his anger toward the unfortunate Garnett. Jackson believed that if Garnett had held on only a few minutes more, reserve troops would have arrived, there would have been no retreat, and darkness would have ended the fighting. Garnett, of course, had never been informed of the battle plan. Acting alone at the wall, he had behaved bravely and had ordered retreat only when, outnumbered and out of ammunition, and facing a possible envelopment by a much larger force, he had no other choice, a decision that all of Jackson's regimental commanders later supported. Jackson himself bore at least some of the responsibility for his defeat. This was his first fight as commanding general. He was learning. He was expanding his understanding of battle, which he had seen before only in pieces. He had done certain things very well, but seen from the front lines, the Battle of Kernstown was lost because Confederate soldiers ran out of ammunition. And that was Jackson's direct responsibility. Kimball made a similar, though less costly, mistake. He had failed to bring forward enough ordnance for his cannons. Jackson had not anticipated an extended firefight and had not brought up reserve cartridges from his supply wagons. Urging his men, as he did at the end, to charge with bayonets against rifles was patently absurd, albeit a pure expression of Jackson's own combativeness. He had also, somewhat mysteriously considering his intimate control of his brigade's fight at Manassas, remained a quarter mile or so from the stone wall. Though there were good reasons for this, he could see the entire battlefield and the Union position more clearly from there, he was not available to redeploy his regiments where they were needed. Kimball suffered from the same problem. He was even farther away from the action. As twilight descended, Fulkerson's 600 men at the western part of the wall were relatively unengaged. They could have been ordered to the eastern wall to great effect. They were fresher. They had ammunition to spare. Finally, Jackson had hampered Garnett's effectiveness by not telling him his battle plan. Garnett did not even know where Jackson was. Perhaps the biggest lesson to be learned from Kernstown, however, involved not fighting, but politics. Jackson's tactical defeat turned out to be one of the great strategic victories of the early war. It began with the sheer fierceness of his troops' resistance, suggesting to the Union command that he was stronger than he actually was. This impression was enhanced by Union-held prisoners, who crowed loudly that Jackson would soon be reinforced by 30,000 troops. Banks, correctly suspicious of such tales, still could not quite bring himself to fully disbelieve them. This revised, more potent version of Jackson was further enhanced by James Shields. Puffing up his own accomplishment, Shields described for the Union War Department the desperate 8-hour battle he had fought against 11,000 Confederate troops, 5 times what Jackson put on the field. He told of how, far from being surprised by Jackson's attack, he had feigned weakness to deliberately lure and trap Jackson. Piling lies on top of lies, he claimed that he had closely managed the battle and even ordered Tyler's brigade to attack. The havoc which has been made in the rank of the rebels has struck a blow such as they have nowhere else endured since the commencement of the war, Shields told the War Department. Jackson and his Stonewall Brigade and all the other brigades accompanying him will never meet this division again in battle. But McClellan and the War Department in Washington drew the opposite conclusion. To them, the battle meant that Jackson was far more dangerous than they had thought. The Valley was not a sideshow. It was a full-blown theater of war. Thus McClellan, still in command of the Valley and alerted to this new danger, made an uncharacteristically decisive move. The sensible thing might have been to leave Shields in the Valley to fight Jackson. Instead, he canceled orders for both of Banks's divisions to leave the Valley. He ordered the brigades that had already departed back to Winchester, and then he ordered a full-out pursuit of the small rebel army. "As soon as you are strong enough, push Jackson hard and drive him well beyond Strasburg," he wrote Banks. He still wanted Banks in Manassas, but now the terms were, "the very moment the thorough defeat of Jackson will permit it." Thus were 19,000 sent out to destroy 3,500, and thus did 2 full divisions become useless to the Union Army east of the Blue Ridge. Jackson's attack reverberated in other ways through the Union command. As McClellan began his epic move southward, Lincoln and Secretary of War Stanton discovered to their horror that he had not left the 25,000-strong force he had promised to protect Washington. This role was to have been assumed by Nathaniel Banks's Fifth Corps, which, of course, had been on its way to Manassas. Jackson's attack at Kernstown was the reason they never got there. McClellan, reluctant to give up any men from his expeditionary force, then proceeded to fudge the troop numbers. He included Banks's Valley divisions in a covering force that was supposedly in and about Washington. It was actually 80 miles from Washington. Lincoln, furious and feeling betrayed, moved swiftly to correct the problem. He ordered troops back to Washington from the Rappahannock, thus killing any immediate idea of a pincer movement on Richmond. Next, he created two new independent commands, the Department of the Shenandoah under Banks and the Department of the Rappahannock under Irvin McDowell. Both generals would report directly to Lincoln and Stanton. With Banks in supposedly headlong pursuit of Jackson in the valley, McClellan, stripped of a good deal of his power, was told sternly to focus on his single objective, Richmond. Chapter 22, The Shooting War. At the distance of a few hundred yards, a man might fire at you all day without your finding it out. That's Ulysses S. Grant making fun of the old 69-caliber muzzle-loading, smoothbore musket the U.S. Army used in the Mexican-American War. He was only slightly exaggerating. Though the weapon threw a frighteningly large projectile and could be fired quickly, up to four times a minute, using one was like shooting a marble from a shotgun. It was famously inaccurate at any range above 100 yards, and often not much good beyond 80 yards. It was the standard infantry weapon of the 1840s and early 1850s, but had changed little since the invention of the muzzle-loading flintlock in France in 1610. The main change was a new detonator, a percussion cap instead of a flint. The smoothbore, which fired a round ball, or buck and ball, had defined warfare during Napoleon's military career, 1793 to 1815. Lots of men stacked in close-order formations, concentrating their firepower on similarly stacked enemy troops, were necessary if anybody was going to hit anything. Battles took place, of necessity, at very close range. But in the years following the Mexican-American War, something happened to the old smoothbore that would change warfare forever and have horrific and far-reaching consequences in the American Civil War. This revolution came in the form of something very small. A conical lead bullet developed in 1849 by a French army officer named Claude Etienne Minier. The mini-ball, as it was known, permitted combat muskets to employ rifling, spiral grooves inside a gun barrel, which made them accurate up to 400 yards and able to kill a man at 1,000 yards. This, in turn, produced the deadliest small-arms fire in human history. Rifles were used by French and British troops in the Crimean War, 1853 to 1856, to devastating effect, and were employed on a massive scale by both sides in the American Civil War. Though the correct pronunciation of the inventor's name was Minier, Americans insisted on pronouncing it without the acute accent, Minnie, which made this brutally destructive invention sound like a child's toy. Minier had solved a very old problem. Gunsmiths had known for several centuries that rifling greatly improved both the range and accuracy of firearms. A bullet that fit the grooves tightly would prevent gases from escaping, thus improving the gun's range, and the rifling gave it spin that greatly improved accuracy. The highly accurate Kentucky long rifle, developed in the 1700s, was a good example of this technology. But such a weapon could be fired only a few times before the gunpowder fouled its grooves, requiring cleaning. A tight-fitting bullet was also harder to ram down the barrel, often jamming on the way. This meant that such rifles were impractical as infantry weapons. Though the smoothbore, which was loaded by ramming a loose-fitting round ball down an unrifled barrel, had far shorter range, it fouled far less frequently, was easy to load, and thus had the advantages of speed and rapidity of fire. Minier's solution was elegant. A self-cleaning, cylindrical bullet with a hollow base that would expand when fired, thus fitting snugly into the barrel's rifling, and in the process clear the residue of the previous shot from the grooves. It could be loaded quickly, the bullet was in its unexpanded state, and many rounds could be fired before the barrel had to be cleaned. By the mid-1850s, rifled muskets using mini-balls that had been simplified by Harper's Ferry armorer James Burton were being mass-produced in America. And in 1855, Secretary of War Jefferson Davis converted the entire U.S. Army to the 58-caliber Springfield rifled musket. That, along with the British-made 577-caliber Enfield, which used the same bullets, would become the main infantry arms of the Civil War. That sort of ruinous power had never before been put into the hands of the common soldier. What made the rifled musket even more lethal was that the battlefield tactics of the Civil War remained largely frozen in the Napoleonic era. A rifle that was reasonably accurate at 300 yards should have dictated infantry formations that were spread out, more like skirmish lines. Instead, Civil War commanders stuck to the old close-order formations that Napoleon had used half a century before. The typical battle line still consisted of men packed shoulder to shoulder, literally touching elbows, and stacked too deep. There were several reasons for this. First, while spreading soldiers out made them less vulnerable, it also took away their main tactical advantage, their ability to concentrate their firepower. A single individual with a musket was irrelevant. Battles were won by hurling more lead, more accurately, at the enemy than the enemy hurled at you. Second, close tactical formations were the only way that officers could control and move men around a battlefield. In the noise and confusion of battle, a regiment of 300 to 600 men had to be able to hear the orders of its colonel and subordinate officers. Those who could not actually hear had to be able to follow the movements of those who did. Imagine, then, a 2,500-man brigade packed into tight battle lines, moving at quick time, which meant they would cover 85 yards a minute, toward the enemy's defensive position. This was the orthodox Civil War charge. Against smoothbores, the men had a very good chance of getting close to the enemy's position. Against rifled muskets fired from cover, the effect approximated pure slaughter. The war is full of examples of generals. One thinks of Ambrose Burnside at Fredericksburg, Robert E. Lee at Gettysburg, and Ulysses S. Grant at Cold Harbor, who continued to throw large bodies of men against entrenched defenders wielding rifled muskets, with catastrophic results. But even without massed frontal assaults, much of the war was fought at 100 to 200 yards, as it was at Kernstown. Absolutely murderous range for the new weapons. This explains why the casualty rate was so much higher for the American Civil War than for preceding wars. Such accuracy makes it even harder to imagine a soldier standing erect in a field in a battle line, unprotected, biting off the paper end of a cartridge, pouring powder down the barrel, ramming a bullet down the barrel with his ramrod, inserting a percussion cap in the breech, then cocking the hammer, a process that took up to 30 seconds, while hundreds or thousands of men on the other side lined him and others like him up in the sights of their rifles. 94% of all men killed and wounded in the war were hit by bullets. Jackson's love of the bayonet was an anachronism. Less than half of 1% of wounds were inflicted by saber or bayonet. That is not to say that the new muskets and their strangely whistling mini-balls did not affect military strategy. They rendered cavalry, for example, nearly useless as an attacking body. Men on horses presented fat targets. Civil War commanders quickly learned how easy it was to empty saddles at long range. They also learned how easy it was to kill mounted officers, and especially generals. 18% of Confederate generals were killed or mortally wounded, mostly by mini-balls. Cavalry, so important as an attacking unit in Napoleon's time, was thus consigned to support work. Scouting and screening, raiding supply lines, or creating diversions, much as Ashby had done in the days preceding the Battle of Kernstown. The role of artillery changed, too. Napoleon had begun battles by moving his artillery up front, then firing canister to blow holes in enemy lines. Infantry charges would follow. Such tactics were used as late as in the Mexican-American War. They worked because the effective range of canister, 250 yards or more, was greater than the 100-yard range of the smoothbores. But now the muskets outranged the cannons. Any general who opened the battle by moving artillery forward would soon see his artillerists and battery horses shot to pieces. To some extent, this is what happened to McDowell in the early afternoon at Manassas. Artillery thus moved back, and while canister was still used, much of the work of the guns was done against the other side's guns, known as counter-battery work. The mini-ball had other effects, too, most notably on the human anatomy, and thus on the medical corps, surgeons, and generals who had to deal with it. The balls fired by smoothbores could, and often did, pass through the body intact, creating an exit wound about the same size as the entrance wound. They were also relatively easy to extract. But the soft, conical, hollow-bottomed mini-balls flattened out, deformed, and often fragmented on impact. As these jagged pieces of lead tumbled through the body, they caused extraordinary damage. If they managed to exit, they caused horrific, gaping wounds far larger than the entrance wound. The bullets, shattering, splintering, sometimes even powdering effects on bones, were usually irreparable, and were the main reasons why surgeons often had no choice but to amputate, and why stacks of human arms and legs were a common sight outside field hospitals. And the soft, tumbling pieces of lead simply shredded whatever internal organs they encountered. Because the injuries they caused were so often crippling or disfiguring, mini-balls had a far more profound impact than round balls on the fighting ability of armies. An army reporting 900 wounded in battle, in a typical example, would lose 70 of those men to death, while the mini's effects meant that 400 would be too crippled ever to fight again. The army thus suffered a permanent loss of nearly 500 men. Round balls were not nearly as destructive. This great revolution, however, arrived unevenly on the battlefields of the American Civil War, a fact that had a large, but largely uncredited, impact on the early war campaigns of Stonewall Jackson. When the war began, in 1861, a high percentage of the weapons in both armies were the old 69 caliber smoothbores. The Union quickly remedied that problem. In 1862, most Federal soldiers were equipped with either Springfield or Enfield rifled muskets. But the Confederacy lagged far behind. Jackson's Valley Army fought at Manassas and in the Valley Campaign with smoothbores, a condition that did not begin to change until he later captured so many Union arms that he was able to partially re-outfit his army. According to a number of descriptions by ordinary soldiers, their equipment at the beginning of the war was badly outdated. John Worsham, an infantryman who served under Jackson, recalled an abundance of smoothbores, including old modified flintlocks, Mississippi rifles, pistols, and double-barreled shotguns. "Not a half a dozen men in the company were armed alike," he wrote. Unlike the Federals, the Confederate Army as a whole was still using smoothbores well into mid-1863. My recollection is that Gettysburg was our first battle in which we were at least entirely rid of smoothbore muskets, wrote Edward Porter Alexander. All of this suggests a rather extreme mismatch in firepower in the early part of the war. This inequality was apparent to soldiers on both sides. In one of Jackson's Valley fights, a Georgia regiment, equipped with 69 caliber smoothbores, stood fire for 2.5 hours from Springfield carrying Federals without being able to respond. In many instances, the Union troops, upon learning that their opponents were shooting outmoded muskets, exposed themselves and taunted their opponents. many of them felt perfectly safe at 100 yards. It is true that at close range, rifles lose some of their advantages over smoothbore muskets. But not all. Rifles are superior weapons, in accuracy and in the sheer destructiveness of their mushrooming, somersaulting bullets. Jackson was forced to deal with this disparity in firepower throughout his Civil War career. In the early going, he had to deal defensively with the effects of this revolution in warfare. His opponents largely did not. Chapter 23, A Fool's Paradise. The days after the Kernstown fight felt disconcertingly familiar. Jackson, mounted on Little Sorrel, chin thrown forward and cap settled on the bridge of his nose, was once again riding south at the head of his tiny, brigade-sized army through the tentative Shenandoah Spring with a much larger Union force in hot pursuit. He had faced an almost identical situation less than a week before, with no apparent options other than headlong retreat. Yet there he was. He was not only palpably there, marching up the valley pike with his men in columns of four, songs on the wind, listen to the mockingbird, and bullet-strafed regimental flags flying proudly, but also, in a few days, he had changed the war itself. With his ferocious little jab at Shields in Kernstown, he had single-handedly knocked McClellan's offensive off balance. By doing that, of course, and by bringing the attention of the world to the Shenandoah Valley, he had also had the effect of doubling the Furies on his heels. Before, he had been chased by a single division, some 9,000 under James Shields, whose purpose was akin to swatting away an insect. Now came 19,000 men under Nathaniel Banks himself, with a more resolute set of orders. In the eyes of the War Department in Washington, Jackson had made himself a worthy foe. Now he would pay for his audacity. Even a casual observer could have told you that Jackson was remarkably alone in the immense theater of Trans Mountain, Virginia. There were no Confederate armies standing by to rescue him. No such orders had been given. What that observer could not have told you was that the same description applied to Jackson's own life. Much of the world Jackson had known at the war's opening had either been wholly transfigured or had vanished altogether. That change had begun with exile from his homeland. The western part of Virginia where he had grown up, soon to be West Virginia, had, since the early days of the war, been in the curious process of seceding from a seceded state. It was already a federal stronghold, crawling with bluecoats, and would formally join the Union within a year. The meaning must have been painfully clear to Jackson. If he had tried to return to his native land, Clarksburg, Jackson's Mill, Beverly, or any of the old haunts where he still had deep family roots, he would be arrested and locked up. He was the enemy. In a very real sense, he could not go home. Nor would he ever again embrace the love and friendship of his sister, Laura. The war famously divided brother from brother. Here, it parted brother from sister. We don't know exactly how the break happened, but it happened precipitously, sometime after the beginning of the war in mid-April 1861. It was very likely the result of Laura's wartime politics. She was as strong-willed as her brother, and she turned out to be an ardent, outspoken Unionist. Curiously, as late as April 6, there is no hint of friction between the two, who had been so close that they usually spent a full month together every summer. His letter to her of that date, a little more than a week before the outbreak of the war, is lengthy, thoughtful, and concerned, as he often was with her relationship with God. He refers to her own very kind letter, and tells her that if necessary he will pay the whole salary of a minister in her hometown of Beverly, rather than see him leave. He goes on. You speak of your temptations. God withdraws his sensible presence from us to try our faith. When a cloud comes between you and the sun, do you fear that the sun will never appear again? I am well satisfied that you are a child of God, and that you will be saved in heaven, there forever to dwell with the ransom of the Lord. So you must not doubt. Jesus says, My yoke is easy and my burden light. And this is true if we but follow him in the prompt discharge of every duty. We should always seek by prayer to be taught our duty. If temptations are presented, you must not think that you are committing sin in consequence of having a sinful thought. Even the Savior was presented with the thought of worshiping Satan. Don't doubt his eternal love for you. Comforting words, yet there the relationship ends, forever. Though Laura's husband, Jonathan Arnold, was a Confederate sympathizer, he would be arrested for it in 1863, and Beverly contained many people who agreed with him, she held fast to her convictions. She nursed sick and wounded Federal soldiers in her own home. She even became something of an embarrassment to Jackson, accusing him publicly on several occasions of cheating on his West Point entrance exam, a charge for which no evidence has ever been found. Though Jackson sometimes queried travelers from Western Virginia for news of her, he rarely spoke of her, and people around him avoided the subject. Much of Jackson's comfortable, familiar old world in Lexington had disappeared, too. Anna and his slaves were gone, the house vacant. She was in North Carolina with family members now. It would be nearly a year before he saw her again. VMI still functioned, but enlistments in the Army had gutted its upper ranks. Most of his former students were already in the war. Many would serve with him, and many would die. His great friend John Lyle, the bookstore owner and debate society founder, was dead. Ellie and Maggie's father, Dr. George Junkin, whom he loved and revered as a surrogate father, pastor, mentor, and counselor, had left Lexington abruptly after Fort Sumter, dragging his heretical Unionist convictions back to Pennsylvania with him. He would never return. It was another crushing loss for Jackson. Maggie and her husband John Preston were Jackson's strongest surviving links to the town, but they, too, were enduring hardship. At the Battle of Kernstown, Maggie's cousin and Jackson's staffer, Lieutenant George G. Junkin, was taken prisoner. Junkin, who had lived with Jackson and Maggie at his uncle, Dr. Junkin's house in Lexington for 2 years, and was close to Jackson, would spend the rest of the war in a Union prison camp. As the tide of war washed his past away, Jackson clung ever more resolutely to the twin pillars of his life, God and duty. Both were in play as never before. Kernstown had been both intimate and brutal, a stark and bloody lesson in what it meant to fight an enemy who was as violent and determined as you were. There could be few illusions any more about what war really meant or about how much Jackson and his men risked. Back in war-shocked, Union-occupied Winchester, the courthouse was jammed with groaning, bleeding, disfigured men from both sides. One observer wrote, A Confederate captain, Yancey Jones, was lying there with both eyes scooped out and the bridge of his nose carried away by a bullet. He was sometimes delirious and roared about forming his company and charging. An Ohio volunteer lay on his back, the brains oozing from a shot in the head, uttering at breathing intervals a sharp, stertorous cry. He'd been lying thus for 36 hours. With the Union occupation of Winchester and the Valley's first real battle at Kernstown came bitterness and new contempt on both sides. The inhabitants believed that the army was a horde of Cossacks and Vandals, wrote David Hunter Strother, the Virginia-born writer who fought under Banks, whose mission was to subjugate the land, to burn, pillage, and destroy. Hence, they are received with distrust and terror, and their slightest disorders magnified by the imagination into monsters and menacing crimes. The Union soldiery, on the other hand, thought they were entering a country so embittered and infuriated that every man they met was a concealed enemy and an assassin, and every woman a spitfire. Strother was himself full of unalloyed contempt for these Virginians, a feeling shared in one form or another by many people in the North. He wrote, I have myself considered the old Virginia people as a decadent race. They have certainly gone down in manners, morals, and mental capacity. There seems to be nothing left of their traditional greatness but a senseless pride and a certain mixture of dignity and suavity of manner, the intelligence of a once great and magnanimous people. It was high time that war had come to wipe out this effete race. That will be the final result of the war, I do not doubt. It was inevitable, too, that a Union army, marching conspicuously through the valley, would clash head-on with the institution of slavery. For many slaves, the opportunity for escape was just too obvious, and many took that chance, crossing through army lines, seeking refuge and asylum. In normal times, which these emphatically were not, the escaped slaves would have been considered property and returned under the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. Some Union commanders in the opening months of the war did precisely that. But then an opportunistic Union general named Ben Butler, who happened to be a lawyer, came up with a new way of thinking about the problem. Confronted in 1861 with a demand for the return of three escaped slaves in coastal Virginia, he decided that if he took seriously Virginia's claim to being a foreign power, and if it was making war upon the United States, then he was under no obligation to return any sort of property. Instead, he would hold the slaves as contrabands of war. The concept, which Lincoln did not like, first because he thought it might destabilize border states, and second because he would not then or later accept the Confederacy's claim to sovereignty, quickly caught on anyway. Congress would support Butler by passing the Confiscation Acts in 1861 and 1862, which allowed for the emancipation of slaves owned by masters in seceded states. There was, in fact, little else the Union could do. Returning escaped slaves on a grand scale to the enemy was, in the long run, an absurd proposition. The contrabands were accepted, put to work, and paid for their services. Soon enough, they would fight too. By the standards of the Deep South, the Shenandoah Valley had relatively few slaves, and almost nothing that resembled the brutal, impersonal culture that often existed on the giant plantations of South Carolina. Only one valley property owner had more than 100 slaves. Most had far fewer than that. But because many of the slaves were rented out to non-slaveholding families for agricultural labor or housework, the institution was more pervasive than the numbers showed. This phenomenon also provided at least one answer to a common question from Union troops. Why, if you do not own slaves, are you fighting for slavery? The answer was that ownership per se was only part of it. The institution pervaded the South on less apparent economic levels. As Banks moved south, growing numbers of slaves began to enter Union lines. At Harper's Ferry, federal troops faced what one soldier called a flood of escapees. In nearby Charlestown, a reporter wrote that hundreds of contrabands are hourly seeking refuge within our lines. They had different reasons for leaving. Some said they were tired of abuse and overwork. Many were treated well but just wanted freedom, or what they imagined it to be. A slave named George Washington, who had worked as a farmer and hotel waiter, said that his owner had never harmed him, but that he simply preferred freedom to slavery. Such defections produced a range of effects, all of them deeply unsettling, on Valley residents. One farmer lost 7 slaves within a few months, 1/3 of his workforce. Some escapees took what Virginians considered to be brazen advantage of the new federal power. A slave named Shipley, accompanied by a Union escort of 25 soldiers, marched boldly to a farm in Newtown to reclaim his wife, Mary. Even more unseemly to Southern sensibilities, hypocritically in some cases, some of the Yankee soldiers enjoyed close relations, sexual and otherwise, with black women. One Confederate officer reported that 3 Union soldiers married black women while they were camped at Winchester. Yet another sign of cultural transfiguration was the sight of a Union colonel lecturing a white slave owner for striking a female slave. Though most slaves stayed home, and many were not so unhappy with their lot that they would risk blind flight. It soon became apparent that as Banks marched through the valley, he was not only pursuing Jackson, he was also tearing at the social and economic fabric of the Confederacy. If one was forced to run for one's life, with a future that might be measured in days or hours instead of months or years, the Shenandoah Valley was a breathtakingly beautiful place in which to do so. 11 months into the war, the place was still mostly unscarred, a graceful, mountain-walled land of clabbered farmhouses and steepled churches, rolling wheat and barley farms, valleys hidden within valleys, and land that rose and fell like gentle swells on the ocean. To outsiders, the valley seemed, as it does today, a sort of idealized, postcard-perfect Currier and Ives version of rural America. In the rain-drenched spring of 1862, it was a thoroughly sodden paradise, too. There was water everywhere, in cataracts that thundered out of the Alleghenies, in the swollen streams that ran along every road and path, and in the deep pools of the winding North Fork of the Shenandoah and its tributaries. Everywhere, too, were the valley's trademark fog and mist, thick and smoke-blue, swirling through valleys and gorges, making mountaintops vanish, and the high ridges seem to float on the air like sleeping giants. Jackson loved the place. "This country is one of the loveliest I have ever seen," he wrote Anna, a sentiment he would express over and over again. It was also, at that moment, one of the most perilous. Though Jackson was directly engaged with two Union divisions, he had many more Union troops in the region to worry about. All threatened him. To his west, just over the Alleghenies in a parallel river valley, now camped Union General John Fremont, the old Pathfinder, disgraced in Missouri, but somehow, through the magic of Republican politics, back in the field. He had 23,000 widely scattered men. Across the Blue Ridge Mountains in Fredericksburg, General Irvin McDowell of Manassas fame had 34,000 men. With Banks's 19,000, the Federals thus had some 76,000 troops in the area. This did not include the Union troops at Harper's Ferry, which by May would have numbered more than 7,000. Opposing them, in the broadest sense, were three small rebel forces. In the Alleghenies, just west of Stanton, were 3,000 troops under General Edward Johnson. Just across the Blue Ridge near Gordonsville, Major General Richard S. Ewell had 8,000. Jackson himself would soon, with the new Confederate draft and the return of stragglers and men on furlough, have about 6,000 men. Together, the Confederate forces totaled some 17,000. Though the 76,000 would never face the 17,000 in a stand-up fight, Jackson would make dead certain of that, that was roughly the size of the troop disparity. They would all, Union and Confederate, figure in what happened in the Valley Theater in the coming months. Jackson's immediate need in the wake of Kernstown was to forestall his own destruction. He moved south, quickly at first, marching 25 miles the first day straight down the Valley Pike to the town of Woodstock. Then, realizing that Banks was not exactly in hot pursuit, he slowed down, making a leisurely 13-mile march the next day to Mount Jackson. Jackson was in no hurry, running as slowly as he possibly could, using Ashby's rear guard to jab insolently at his pursuers. Banks followed, ever more sluggishly, then stopped altogether. Jackson, staying just out of reach behind Ashby's cavalry screen, stopped too, seeing no point in running from someone who was not chasing him. Amazingly, considering the order McClellan had given Banks, Jackson and his army were able to remain in the immediate area of Mount Jackson for the next 23 days, unmolested and unpursued. It was a stall worthy of McClellan himself. Jackson moved only once during that time, shifting a few miles south to a more defensible piece of high ground east of the pike and just south of Mount Jackson, called Rood's Hill. With nowhere near enough men to attack Banks, but with free time suddenly on his hands, Jackson turned his attention to other things, such as reorganizing his army, which was still woefully short of supplies, weapons, and other equipment. While there, he was confronted with a revolt of 200 militiamen in Rockingham County who had fortified themselves in the mountains and vowed to fight the new draft. Jackson put the mutiny down with characteristic grim efficiency. He sent 7 regiments of infantry accompanied by cavalry and artillery, more than 3,000 men, who shelled the mutineers into submission. They were all arrested, briefly jailed, then placed back in the ranks. Jackson's dispassionate, business-like approach to such problems made him even more formidable as a disciplinarian. The men knew that it would make little or no difference to him if he had to shoot them. Duty was duty. Meanwhile, what was holding back this 20,000-man Union army, fresh from its inspiring victory at Kernstown? The answer was, primarily, Nathaniel Prentice Banks. Like McClellan, he was a deeply cautious man. And like McClellan, he had to have his men and materiel precisely right before engaging the enemy. And everything was emphatically not right in the valley. There was, to begin with, the atrocious weather. Constant driving rain, freezing winds, sleet, snow, and storms that encrusted men, horses, tents, and equipment in ice and caused tall trees to topple. Supply and artillery wagons churned the meadows into a deep, slippery ooze that mired horses and men and cannons and anything that fell into it. Sometimes the mud was so deep the men could not even drill, abiding in their frozen, muck-filled tents and trying vainly in the wind and rain to keep campfires alive. There was the problem of supplies, too, or lack of them, Banks told the War Department. The Harper's Ferry to Winchester Railroad was out of service. His men were on half rations. Some of them had no shoes. Banks complained bitterly, too, about the incompetence of his cavalry. Here, he really did have an insurmountable problem. His men could not ride or shoot with Ashby's troopers, who bedeviled them at every turn. The Southern horsemen destroyed bridges and culverts, waited in ambush, and fired their light artillery at the invading Yankees from around blind corners. But Banks could not remain in place forever. On April 17, with clearing weather, his 2 divisions finally lumbered forward. At 7 a.m., his advance regiments triumphantly entered Mount Jackson, where they found nothing but the burning supplies and equipment the rebel army had left behind. Jackson had seen them coming. By midday, the Union troops were pounding, under a hot sun, uphill through the muck toward Jackson's camp at Rood's Hill. Banks believed that if Jackson was going to stand and fight, he would do it there, on this easily defended piece of high ground, a mile to the east of the Valley Pike, with a commanding view of the plain below. At last, Banks was ready to fight. With this in mind, he drew up his full corps in the wide river bottom just south of Mount Jackson, in what soldiers on both sides remember as one of the more striking military displays of the day. His infantry formed battle lines, as though preparing for a frontal assault. By late afternoon, Banks's skirmishers were moving forward toward the crest of the hill. But Jackson had anticipated this, too. Instead of an entrenched army, what the exhausted Federals found was an abandoned camp with the ashes of campfires. The only evidence of Confederates were the few stray shells tossed at them by Ashby's vanishing rear guard. Jackson had never had any intention of fighting at Rood's Hill. Indeed, he was happy to let Banks have Mount Jackson, and a lot more of the valley as well. An hour or two before anticipating the Federal advance, he had put his army back on the turnpike heading south, once again staying just out of Banks's range. Jackson, who knew he could move faster than his enemy, did not seem especially worried. He sent everything he did not need on to Stanton, then bivouacked for the night about 12 miles north of Harrisonburg. The next day he moved off the Valley Pike and headed east under the shadow of the southern end of Massanutten Mountain through the tiny towns of McGehee'sville and Conrad Store, now Elkton, and onward through the persistent mud to a smaller declivity within the Luray Valley known as Elk Run Valley. There, on April 19, his army made camp. None of his officers had even a vague idea of what he had in mind. Most of the men thought he was simply running away, and that they would soon be driven ignominiously from the valley where many of them lived. Such, they might have reasoned, were the mathematics of war. But somehow, in this bizarre, unwinnable endgame, Jackson had managed to find a superb little sanctuary. Elk Run Valley butted up against the towering Blue Ridge, which meant that Jackson's flanks were anchored in dense, steep, pathless forests. In his front was the swollen to bursting South Fork of the Shenandoah, a far more formidable river than the lazier North Fork. And behind him he had a reliable escape hatch, a well-maintained road that led up and over the Blue Ridge and out of the valley at Swift Run Gap. Not only was Banks unlikely to attack him there with the force he had, but Jackson was poised, if Banks made a run at Stanton, to hit him from behind. Now again something remarkable happened. Banks, his rickety supply lines lengthening, his worries mounting over the inadequacy of his cavalry, stopped pursuing Jackson. He remained at New Market for 5 days, then inched cautiously southward to the town of Harrisonburg, where he came to a full stop. This time he had a far more plausible reason for cutting off pursuit. On April 19, he had presented the War Department with the remarkable news that Jackson had left the valley. The Confederate general had disappeared, as though with a blinding flash of light, into the mist-shrouded ranges of the Blue Ridge. On April 20, Banks certified it. The flight of Jackson from this valley, by way of the mountains, from Harrisonburg, toward Stannardsville and Orange Courthouse, on Gordonsville, is confirmed this morning by our scouts and prisoners. This was wholly untrue. Jackson was sitting in his pocket valley in the far eastern part of the larger Shenandoah Valley, less than 20 miles from the desk in Harrisonburg, where Banks was writing his dispatches. What accounted for Banks's blindness? It almost certainly had to do with the ineptness of his cavalry, which was not talented or brave enough to penetrate the brilliant Ashby's screens. It also had to do with Banks's desire to participate in the battle for Richmond, which was not going to happen if he was chasing Jackson's broken and pathetic little force in the valley. Banks wanted to believe that Jackson had gone. On April 22, as though to persuade himself that it was absolutely incontrovertibly true, he repeated that Jackson has abandoned the Valley of Virginia permanently. On April 24, he spoke of Jackson at his present location near Stannardsville, which was east of the Blue Ridge in the Piedmont country. Jackson, of course, hadn't moved. Leaving the valley permanently, in fact, was the last thing on his mind. While Banks was assuring Stanton that Jackson was nothing to worry about, Jackson was quietly concocting a plan to drive Banks himself from the valley. To Banks and his officers, the meaning of Jackson's departure was clear. Their work was done. "There is nothing more to be done by us in the valley," he wrote Secretary of War Stanton on April 30, using words that he would come to regret. "Nothing this side of Strasburg requires our presence." North of Strasburg was the B&O Railroad, Washington's main supply channel to the west, which would always be a matter of strategic concern. He added that Jackson's army is reduced, demoralized, on half rations. Banks's cool, self-possessed tone convinced Washington that he was right. Lincoln and Stanton already believed that he had pushed perhaps a bit too deeply into Virginia, putting too much distance between him and other Union commands. The result was that on May 1, Secretary of War Stanton ordered Banks to fall back with the force under your immediate command to Strasburg. More important, he also ordered Banks to detach Shields' division and send it to General McDowell in Fredericksburg. It seemed a curious finish to a curious campaign. Early in March, Banks had swaggered into Virginia with 20,000 men and seized Winchester. One of his divisions had beaten Jackson at Kernstown, then driven him down the valley. But there had been no follow-through. In the 30 days after Kernstown, his 5th Corps had covered a mere 67 miles, during which time he had failed to catch, and then had lost altogether, a small Confederate army. And now, soon, he would be turning around, retracing his steps. The campaign was all strangely inconclusive. At about this time, something happened, quietly and without attracting notice, that would have a profound impact on the course of the war. Jackson, in his camp in Elk Run Valley, started to correspond for the first time, in earnest, with Robert E. Lee, and thus began an extraordinary partnership. Though Lee was officially President Davis's military advisor, the former had begun, with Davis's full approval, to function more like his chief of staff. And as more and more of Johnston's, Davis's, and the War Department's time was consumed dealing with McClellan's move up the peninsula, Lee began to exert more influence on the rest of Virginia. He was mostly trying to prevent McDowell, with his 34,000 men at Fredericksburg, from advancing on Richmond and linking his forces with McClellan's. Jackson had already proven his ability to tie up Union troops in Virginia. Quietly, informally, and with Davis's approval, Lee had assumed de facto charge of the valley. On April 21, Lee wrote a letter to Jackson that must have seemed a revelation to the younger man. Jackson's order since March had always been, in effect, to protect himself and his supply lines, to venture near the enemy, but not too near, to engage the enemy without taking undue risks. Now he heard a new voice, using an entirely new vocabulary. Lee opened by telling Jackson that he was worried about the concentration of Union troops near Fredericksburg. He then wrote, "If you can use General Ewell's division in an attack on General Banks and to drive him back, it will prove a great relief to the pressure on Fredericksburg." Attack. Drive him back. Lee had watched Jackson's bold, if imperfect, moves in the campaigns leading to Romney and Kernstown. Reading Jackson's correspondence from the valley, he was convinced that the two shared the same deeply aggressive instincts. It is worth noting that at this moment, few in either the United States or the Confederate States yet had any idea of this rougher, more combative side of the courtly, soft-spoken Lee. Jackson was one of the first to see it and grasp it. Somehow, the two kindred spirits, whose personalities could not have been more different, had found each other. And now Lee was offering Jackson precisely the opportunity he was looking for. On April 25, he went further. "I have hoped in the present divided condition of the enemy's forces," Lee wrote, "that a successful blow may be dealt them by a rapid combination of our troops. The blow, wherever struck, must, to be successful, be sudden and heavy. I cannot pretend at this distance to direct operations depending on circumstances unknown to me and requiring the exercise of discretion and judgment as to time and execution, but submit these suggestions for your consideration." This was music Jackson had been waiting to hear. What Lee got back from Jackson on April 29 was exactly what he wanted: proposals for 3 different, equally daring, offensive strikes at Union forces. One against Fremont's vanguard west of Stanton, another against one of Banks's detached forces near New Market, and still another against Front Royal and Winchester in the northern part of the valley. Pleased, Lee left the choice to Jackson. That was just as well, because Jackson had already decided on the first, and probably the most audacious, of the 3. By the time Jackson received Lee's response, his men were already marching. Stanton, the prosperous commercial center of the Southern Valley, a critical base of food, clothing, arms, and other supplies, and the vital railhead of the Virginia Central Railroad, was the true key to military operations west of the Blue Ridge. Losing Stanton meant losing the valley, and giving the Union the ideal staging ground for an eastward strike against Richmond. Stanton must be held. But the town was now threatened by 2 Union armies. On April 27, the vanguard of Fremont's Western Virginia Force, 3,000 men under General Robert H. Milroy, had seized the tiny, mountain-ringed town of McDowell, 28 miles west and north of Stanton. Still further north, at Franklin, was General Robert C. Schenck, with another 3,000. Behind him, in the long valley of the South Fork of the Potomac, was Fremont himself with roughly 10,000 more. Banks, meanwhile, had 19,000 at Harrisonburg, 28 miles north and east of Stanton. That gave the Union some 35,000 troops within striking range of Stanton. United, they would be able to seize the town and its critical railhead, thus completing the strategic conquest of the valley. That was the problem. Jackson's solution was an extremely risky military operation. It would depend heavily on both speed and deception. He would move through the valley to Stanton, directly in front of Banks's encamped army at Harrisonburg, and in full view of Banks's scouts and spies. There was no other way he could go, and join forces with General Edward Johnson. Together they would strike Milroy's Union force at McDowell before he could be reinforced by Fremont. Jackson would then turn, head back into the valley, and link with General Richard Ewell, who was currently camped with his division just on the other side of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Together, they would attack Banks. If Lee had doubts, he must have, considering how many things could go wrong with such a plan, starting with the likelihood that Banks would attack Jackson at Stanton, he did not express them. Perhaps it was enough that whatever Jackson did, he would cause headaches for the Union. Keeping to his Winchester vow to hold no war councils, Jackson told no one but Lee, and even Lee got only the barest of essentials. His generals, from Ewell to Johnson, were told only the parts of it that they absolutely had to know, which, of course, drove both of them to distraction. Jackson's first step was to summon Ewell, who promptly crossed Swift Run Gap and entered the easternmost part of the valley on April 30 with 8,000 men. The idea was for him to take Jackson's place at Elk Run Valley, while Jackson moved west to Stanton. Ewell possibly understood that his purpose was to threaten Banks's flank, but he did not know what Jackson planned to do, or who or when he might be planning to attack. Ewell's men and officers, who were thrilled to be marching to the valley, were under the impression that they were going to join up with Jackson's army, and were excited at the prospect. But when they arrived, they found, to their astonishment, that Jackson's army, whose distant campfires they had seen the previous evening, was nowhere in sight. "There was nothing, save the smoldering embers of the campfires of the night previous," wrote one soldier later. "Jackson had disappeared, whither, no one seemed to know. Quietly, in the dead of night, he'd arisen from his blanket and calling his troops around him, with them had disappeared." Ewell, who understood that he was being kept in the dark, was angry and frustrated, a reaction that was fully in keeping with his character. Dick Ewell was one of that impressive array of volatile, difficult, and highly idiosyncratic personalities who populated the Confederate Army's upper ranks. He was a slight 5'7", with a broad, prominent dome of balding scalp above a fringe of brown hair, an angular nose, and a less than luxuriant beard and mustache. In the famous description of his fellow Confederate General Richard Taylor, Ewell, with his bright, prominent eyes, and a nose like that of François of Valois, bore a striking resemblance to a woodcock, and this was increased by his bird-like habit of putting his head on one side to utter quaint speeches. "He was also," wrote Taylor, "a person of singular modesty. Like Jackson, he suffered from dyspepsia. He would often dine only on a special preparation of wheat. He was an odd mixture of gentleness and brutal profanity." "He was a compound of anomalies," wrote John B. Gordon, later a general, who served in Ewell's brigade. "The oddest, most eccentric genius in the Confederate Army. He was in truth as tender and sympathetic as a woman, but even under slight provocation he became externally as rough as a polar bear." While what Lee later termed his quick alternations from elation to despondency and his want of decision made him ill-suited for independent command, he was at bottom a smart, tough officer who liked to fight, could follow orders, and harbored no grand ambitions. He had graduated 13th of 42 cadets in the West Point class of 1840 and served with distinction in Mexico and later in the American West. He was liked and respected by his men, who affectionately called him Old Baldhead. Standing in the mud below Swift Run Gap, staring at the picturesque fields, woodlands, and quaint grist mills of the valley below, he could not help but wonder what Jackson, about whose sanity he was already beginning to question, had in mind. He stayed put, stewed about his predicament, kept his own counsel, and waited for orders. Jackson, meanwhile, was on the move, pushing his force through a nightmare of mud and quicksand and moving water to Port Republic, heading for a pass through the Blue Ridge, known as Brown's Gap. The 16-mile march was agonizingly slow. According to staff member Henry Kidd Douglas, it was conducted over soft and bottomless roads into which horses and wagons and artillery sank, at times almost out of sight. Dragged along by main forces of horses and men, the general himself on foot, lifting and pushing amid the struggling mass. Jackson often dismounted to help gather fence rails and stones to give the wagons more traction. Once, while he was doing that, he found himself behind a common soldier who was doing the same thing and cursing Jackson for putting him through such travails. "It is for your own good, sir," came the voice. And the man turned and beheld the general himself. Dead horses and busted wagons littered the sides of the road. Weather was not the only worry. The men were exhausted. They were also eating a shockingly deficient diet. The basic Confederate fare in the war consisted of two principal items, salt pork and cornmeal. The former, sometimes called bacon or sow belly, was what most Americans of the era would have considered nasty stuff. Often blue-colored, cloyingly salty, fatty meat with hair, dirt, and skin left on. When the order was given to cook 3 days' rations, soldiers would gather in small messes around a fire and a pot and attempt to render their food into a form that could be carried in their grease-logged canvas haversacks. This process usually began by cooking the chunks of pork, then taking the grease and mixing it with the cornmeal. That mixture could be mixed with water, then fried to make easily transportable corn dodgers or other types of cooked cornbread patties. Either way, it was cornmeal and grease. Needless to say, such a diet was hard on the digestive tract. Sometimes their commissary departments did not even have sufficient supplies of salt pork, in which case soldiers would be given the dreaded, unpalatable salt beef, a nauseating horror made of the lesser parts of the cow, organs, neck, head, that the soldiers called salt horse. To dress it up, they would chop it, stew it in water, then crumble cornbread into it. The mixture was called couche, and it was not much of an improvement. The coffee was rarely authentic, more likely a substitute made from such things as chicory, roasted acorns, okra seeds, or wheat. Though this was the basic diet, it was not all Confederate soldiers ate. If they were lucky, or if they had captured Union supplies, they might get molasses, sugar, peanuts, dried peas, and even fresh vegetables. Their picket guards often traded with their Union counterparts, exchanging Southern tobacco for authentic Northern coffee. If they had time, they foraged for everything from corn to apples, peaches, cherries, spring onions, potatoes, eggs, and turnips. Best of all were the packages from home. But most of this was a matter of serendipity. Jackson's troops often subsisted on what might be considered starvation rations, which were virtually a guarantee of poor health. On May 3, a warm, sunny spring day at last, Jackson and his army finally crested the heights of Brown's Gap, crossed through the Blue Ridge Mountains, and descended through the brilliantly green, rolling landscape of Albemarle County to a small depot on the Virginia Central Railroad, known as Meacham's River Station. Word of his departure, which ricocheted through the Southern Valley, was greeted with shock and sadness in Stanton and other cities. Suddenly, the appalling news spread through the valley that Jackson had fled to the east side of the Blue Ridge, wrote artillerist John M. Bowden. Only Ashby remained behind with 1,000 cavalry. Despair was fast settling on the minds of the people. As it was among Jackson's own men, convinced now that they really were leaving for good. At Meacham's River Station, Jackson had, remarkably, managed to commandeer half a dozen trains with locomotives, which stood along the main tracks and sidings. His men boarded the cars sullenly. A few regiments departed on foot. "No one doubted," wrote Imboden, "that the train was to be taken to Richmond. It was Sunday, and many of his sturdy soldiers were valley men. With sad and gloomy hearts, they boarded the trains. When all were on, lo, they took a westward course." Loud cheers rang through the cars. They weren't running away after all. They were going back to the valley. If Jackson's men did not know whom they were going to fight, at least they knew where they were and in which direction they were going, facts that continued to elude the Union command. Jackson's cat-and-mouse game in late April and early May was a work of considerable tactical brilliance, even if some of its effects were unintentional. Early Jackson historians gave him full credit for his deception. Certain later chroniclers took some or all of that credit away. But a close reading of Union war dispatches shows that in a world full of spies, traitors, deserters, casual informants, and escaped slaves, where military secrets often migrated through enemy lines with amazing speed, Jackson managed to confuse almost everybody, and almost all of that confusion worked to his own advantage. Banks was Jackson's principal victim. Almost from the moment he had been ordered to Stanton to withdraw and divide his forces, he'd begun to have second thoughts, alternating between confusion and worry about his own well-being. Judging from his dispatches, he began to be afraid for his soon-to-be-split army's safety, a condition that would worsen in the coming weeks. On May 2, less than 3 days after reasserting the absolute truth of his claim that Jackson had left the valley, Banks wrote Fremont that Jackson was seen today moving toward Port Republic. His march is possibly a feint, possibly to join Johnson and attack Milroy near Stanton. Thus, Banks had completely reversed himself. Jackson was in the valley after all, he now asserted. Jackson was not only there, but was also in motion and dangerous. Banks happened to be right for a change, and he was miraculously right again in his May 3 wire to Stanton, saying that Jackson had been reinforced in the valley by Ewell. Now Banks began to rethink those sweepingly dismissive dispatches of just a few days before. "I do not think it possible to divide our force at this time with safety," he wrote Stanton that same day, in a new cautionary tone that must have mystified the Secretary of War. Shields was still with him and would not depart with his 10,000 men until May 12. The next day Banks, now reconciled to Jackson's supposed presence in the valley, wired to say that our officers are all confident that Jackson's force is near Port Republic. But, once again, he was completely wrong. This time the reason was, ironically, that Jackson had finally fulfilled Banks's own earlier claims and actually left the valley. Just how befuddled the Union command was as a whole was evident in Irvin McDowell's note to James Shields on May 2, while Jackson was mired in the mud on the way to Brown's Gap, saying that he was well east of the Blue Ridge, and that he had pushed through Gordonsville on his way to Richmond. At this point, May 4 and 5, Banks, Fremont, Milroy, and the entire Union command lost Jackson entirely. Their dispatches reflect this. They had seen him moving toward Port Republic, and then, suddenly, they did not see him at all. Jackson's railroad ploy was, in retrospect, brilliant. No one saw through it. By feinting east across the Blue Ridge, then making an about-face and moving his force by train from Meacham's River Station to Stanton, he had effectively made his army disappear. Banks, unaware of this movement, which placed his own army squarely in Jackson's rear, an enormous tactical advantage, asserted with placid confidence in a dispatch to Stanton on May 6 that Jackson's force, which he still believed was near Port Republic, was greatly demoralized and broken. Union General Robert Milroy was just as badly deceived. On that same day, he wrote his boss, John Fremont, saying that Jackson's movement from Port Republic